album. That's what they all say. Out December 11th. I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
People seeking U.S. citizenship will now be required to take a longer and more complex test. The test centers on civics, a study of the rights and duties of citizenship. There are now 128 subjects relating to American history and government for applicants to study before taking the test. There used to be 100 subjects. The new test requires applicants to answer 20 questions instead of 10. To pass, individuals must answer 12 questions correctly, or 60%. This is the same pass rate as before. The process of becoming a U.S. citizen is known as naturalization. Passing the naturalization test is the final requirement for legal permanent residents, also known as green card holders, to become American citizens. A U.S. immigration official asks the applicant the questions during a naturalization interview, one of the final steps in the process. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is the federal agency that administers the country's naturalization and immigration system. Last year, it announced it was improving the naturalization test for the first time since 2008. The change became official last week. Anyone applying for U.S. naturalization after December 1, 2020, must take the new test version. The USCIS's acting director, Ken Cusinelli, said in July it was the agency's responsibility to improve and keep the test current in order to help new citizens fully understand the meaning of U.S. citizenship and the values that unite all Americans. While many questions have not changed, some have been reworded and others will require additional explanation in the answers. For example, the former test asked, "There were 13 original states. Name three." The new version states, "There were 13 original states. Name five." Instead of "What are two rights of everyone living in the United States?" an applicant must now answer, "What are three rights of everyone living in the United States?" Some immigrant rights groups have criticized the new test, saying some questions were made more difficult without a clear reason to do so. Aaron Reichlin Melnick is with the American Immigration Council. He raised concerns that some questions were influenced by politics. On the old test, applicants could be asked, "Who does a U.S. senator represent?" The suggested answer was, "All people of the state," he said. On the new test, the suggested answer is citizens of their state. This is not correct, Reichlin Melnick said. Members of Congress represent everyone who lives within their district, regardless of citizenship status. It's been that way since the nation was founded. A 2018 study by the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation found that only 1 in 3 U.S.-born citizens would pass the former naturalization test. USCIS said it finalized the new test with the help of community-based organizations and volunteers across the country in summer 2020. The data collected from this pilot was used to help USCIS make determinations about the language and grammatical structure of individual test items, the agency said. Sarah Pierce is a policy expert at the Washington, D.C.-based Migration Policy Institute. She said the test changes could possibly triple the amount of time each immigration officer needs to spend with applicants. These changes reduce the efficiency of this already struggling agency, Pierce said. The administration is adding hundreds of thousands of more minutes to these naturalization exams. I'm Brian Lynn.
Months ago, 10-year-old Hassan Mirzam Muhammad of Yemen was so malnourished he was unable to walk. His father had to carry him into a medical center. A photographer with Reuters news agency captured Hassan's image. The photograph was named one of Reuters' Pictures of the Year. Now, after medical treatment, Hassan is able to play with toys and uses hand signals and a smile to communicate. He has been unable to speak since birth. But malnutrition continues to threaten him and 2 million other Yemeni children. War, economic collapse, and the coronavirus crisis have all pushed the country toward its worst famine in years. Hassan eats what we eat, rice, bread. We don't have fat-rich foods nowadays. We cannot find meat for him, his uncle, Tayeb Muhammad, told Reuters. Hassan has lost some of the weight he gained during treatment since returning to his family's small shelter. His family has been forced to find new shelter 5 times because of the ongoing war. The family now lives in Hajja, a very poor area of the country. There is no work for Hassan's father. When Reuters reporters first met Hassan in July, he weighed just 9 kilograms. A struggling local doctors group sent him to the capital city, Sana'a, for treatment. A charity paid for his treatment. Today, Hassan weighs just over 13 kilograms. The boy still needs additional treatment. His body is weak again, his uncle told Reuters. Dr. Ali Yahya Hayir works at Hassan's local medical center. He said the family needs containers of food delivered to their home until the child's health and the family's situation improve. Famine has never been officially declared in Yemen, yet the 5-year-long war has left 80% of the population in need of food aid. The United Nations calls the situation in Yemen the world's largest humanitarian crisis. I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed many of our daily habits, from how we greet our friends to how we work. These changes have developed to limit the spread of the new coronavirus. And it raises a question. What habits or customs will remain after the pandemic ends? Barun Mathema of Columbia University is unsure. Mathema is a doctor and an assistant professor of epidemiology, the study of the spread and control of diseases. He told VOA News that people may keep some of the habits. Or perhaps, he added, as the memory of the pandemic itself fades, so will these habits. Even before the current pandemic, it was normal in many countries for people to wear a face covering in public. For example, face masks became more common in East Asia in 2003 with the rise of SARS, a viral respiratory disease. However, there is no tradition of mask wearing in the United States. A year ago, if you saw someone here wearing a mask in public, you might think they were sick or even strange. Today, however, wearing a mask to prevent the spread of COVID-19 is the new normal for many Americans. As of November 20th, 37 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico require people to wear face coverings in public. But is this a habit that will remain after the pandemic is over? Boris Lushniak leads the School of Public Health at the University of Maryland. He says Americans will most likely wear masks this winter to protect against the common cold and influenza. However, he does not think mask wearing will become a new nationwide habit. He noted that it has been difficult to get some people to wear them in the middle of a pandemic. Lushniak says the custom of shaking another person's hand is likely to become less common in the years to come. He predicts that people will choose to wave or use some other greeting. Overall, Americans might be less willing to touch others, says Aaron Glatt, a spokesperson for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He predicts that the ease of touching friends and coworkers will happen less often. Another lasting effect could be an expectation of higher levels of cleanliness. Mathema of Columbia University told VOA that going through something like a pandemic, regardless of how you feel politically, is a frightening event. He added that some hygiene habits, like frequent hand washing and cleaning surfaces, are likely to stay. And that could be one of the pandemic's silver linings, a good result from a bad situation. Another silver lining, added Aaron Glatt, is that people know more about the spread of some diseases. They also may not accept uncleanliness or poor hygiene. Some businesses have had to make changes too. This is especially true of service industries, such as airlines, restaurants, and stores. For example, many companies use less contact during the pandemic. There are fewer paper receipts to sign when purchasing products or meals. Airline companies have new rules for disinfecting surfaces and the air inside the airplanes. Lushniak, the University of Maryland professor, told VOA that the more important part of the post-pandemic world will be changes to businesses. We learned that cleanliness is important, that disinfection is important, he said, and we will continue doing that in the workplace. Another long-term effect of the pandemic could be more people working from home and staying at home when sick. Lushniak added that the pandemic has created more opportunities for working online. If people are not feeling well, they can simply work from home. In a post-pandemic world, he said, working from home might be an important part of stopping the spread of disease. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Ulysses Grant served two terms in office. His administration was marked by corruption. The president himself was not linked directly to any of the incidents, but he was friends with dishonest members of the cabinet and Congress. Jack Weitzel and Tony Riggs tell how Grant's problems affected the Republican Party in the presidential election of 1876.
The American people were very disappointed with President Grant. He was the military hero of the Civil War. He had led the Union Army of the North to victory over the Confederate Army of the South. His popularity dropped, however, during his presidency. Grant was not an effective political leader, nor was he able to control the men around him. The American people also were worried about the nation's economic situation. A serious depression had begun during Grant's second term. Many people were out of work. They blamed the ruling Republican Party.
The state and congressional elections of 1874 were an important turning point. Republicans were shocked by the results. For the first time in 18 years, the Democratic Party won control of the House of Representatives. They won 169 seats. The Republicans won 109. Democrats also won control of 23 of the 35 state governments. These included several northern states where people were tired of Republican rule.
Important changes also were made in the South. Democrats won control of southern state governments from radical Republicans. One of these states was Mississippi. White Democrats there began organizing groups called White Leagues. These groups wanted to prevent blacks from voting for radical Republicans. They started riots in which many blacks were killed. they also used economic power against blacks. These efforts succeeded. Most blacks were too afraid to vote. The Democrats took control of both the Mississippi legislature and the governor's office. Similar actions with similar results took place in other southern states.
As Grant's second term came to an end, he began to talk about the possibility of another 4 years in the White House. Republican politicians were firmly opposed. They blamed Grant for the party's defeats in state and congressional elections. Grant had to give up any hope of a third term. Congressman James Blaine seemed to have the best chance of winning the Republican presidential nomination in 1876. Blaine had been Speaker of the House of Representatives when the Republicans controlled Congress. He was powerful, and he had many supporters. Some Republican leaders, however, questioned his honesty. Blaine fought this criticism with an emotional speech in Congress.
When the Republican Party convention opened in Cincinnati, Ohio, Blaine was the leading candidate for the presidential nomination. He expected to win the first day. There was a wild demonstration of support when his name was put before the convention. But before the voting could begin, the lights went out. Some delegates believed Blaine's opponents were responsible. These opponents worked all night to get other delegates to change their support from Blaine to another candidate. When the delegates voted the next morning, Blaine did not have enough votes to win the nomination.
However, after six ballots, Blaine appeared ready to win. To stop him, his opponents needed to unite behind another candidate. One of these candidates was Rutherford Hayes, the governor of Ohio. Hayes had fewer enemies than the other candidates, so he became the compromise candidate for delegates hoping to stop Blaine. On the seventh ballot of the convention, Rutherford Hayes captured the Republican nomination.
The Democratic Party met in St. Louis, Missouri. Delegates nominated Samuel Tilden, the governor of New York. Tilden had led the fight to end dishonesty in government in New York State. He had ousted a group called the Tweed Ring, which controlled New York City politics for years. Democrats said he was the man to end dishonesty in government in Washington. Republicans campaigned by denouncing the Democratic Party. They called it the party of Southern rebellion and treason. Instead, they said, vote for the Republican Party, the party that had saved the Union. Democrats campaigned by attacking Republican dishonesty. They blamed Republicans for the nation's economic problems, and they promised better times for everyone if their candidate was elected.
The presidential election of 1876 was very close. By midnight of Election Day, The results seemed to show that Democrat Samuel Tilden was the winner. Republican Rutherford Hayes went to bed believing he had lost. However, the Republicans quickly saw that the electoral votes of three southern states could decide the winner. In the American presidential system, whoever wins the most popular votes in a state usually gets all the electoral votes of that state. In 1876, the electoral votes of three states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, were enough to give the White House to one candidate or the other.
Each party claimed victory in these three states. Each accused the other of stealing votes and counting ballots unfairly. Finally, the two parties agreed to form an electoral committee to decide who had won the disputed votes. The committee was supposed to include seven Republicans, seven Democrats, and one independent. But before it could meet, the independent member resigned. A Republican took his place. The Republicans had a majority.
The committee first debated the disputed votes of Florida. After much discussion, the eight Republicans on the committee voted to accept the votes of Florida's Republican electors. They rejected a proposal to investigate the way the votes were counted in the state. They said there was not enough time for a full investigation. The same thing happened with the disputed votes of Louisiana and South Carolina. The Republicans on the committee voted to count the Republican electors. The Democrats voted to count the Democratic electors. In each case, the Republicans won by a vote of 8-7.
As a result, Rutherford Hayes gained the electoral votes of all three states. This gave him enough to win the election. Democrats were furious. Democrats in many states began organizing party militia groups. They said they would fight, if necessary, to prevent the Republicans from stealing the presidency. The situation seemed very tense and dangerous. Many feared the start of another civil war. Negotiations finally provided a peaceful solution.
Representatives of the two parties met secretly to work out a compromise. The Democrats agreed to permit Republican Rutherford Hayes to be sworn in as president. In return, Hayes agreed to end federal support of radical Republican governments in the South. He promised to name Southerners to his cabinet and other important jobs. And he said he would provide more federal aid for schools and railroads in the South. As part of the agreement, Hayes promised not to act aggressively to support the civil rights of black Southerners.
Hayes' opponent, Democrat Samuel Tilden, did not oppose the agreement. Tilden was an old man. His health was poor. He agreed that 4 years of Rutherford Hayes would be better than 4 years of civil war. So it was that Rutherford Hayes became the 19th president of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.